I wasn't here. Right? What the fuck was I thinking? Like, I was gonna be in a relationship? I'm a fucking psycho. That's why I'm good at what I do. That's how I operate. I am the best because I didn't have any of this fucking bullshit. Right? I could focus and I could concentrate and I had a routine and I had fucking cell reception. I don't need to provide amusement or enjoyment. I don't need to receive any amusement or enjoyment. I'm completely fine with that. Because no amount of good is worth how terrible this feels. It's just a complete waste of fucking time.
Lance, I have a big question for you. Did you survive Barbenheimer weekend? Were you one of the 18.5 million people that bought tickets to either of those movies?
No.
Neither was I. Look at us. Do you know how much Barbie made this weekend? Are you up to speed?
I am up to speed on two things. One, that I thought it was one of the more genius marketing plays I have seen in quite some time as to how to relaunch a brand. And they had to put hundreds of millions of dollars into this, but the franchise is worth billions of dollars. So, but someone made that call to do that. And I thought that was brilliant. And two, the amount of media was extraordinary. I don't watch a lot of TV, a couple hours a week, literally.
Yeah.
And I could not turn on a channel without seeing something Barbie. So for their sake, for the movie business sake, I'm hoping what you're going to tell me is that they had a blockbuster weekend.
This weekend collectively was the fourth biggest U.S. weekend ever. Barbie made a projected $155 million 3-day gross.
Oh my God.
And Oppenheimer made like 81, which was significant, much higher than what Indy did or Mission Impossible did. So that in and of itself has now been overshadowed. And, you know, and any other weekend, Oppenheimer would have been a massive number, but it was overshadowed by Barbie. And then to think that these two distinctly different films opened on the same weekend, which a year ago, neither studio had any idea that this was going to happen, where social media was going to basically drive this thing to the finish line and create this movement called Barbenheimer, where people wanted to do matinees, you know, back to back and see both movies on a Saturday afternoon. That's sort of what happened this weekend. And everybody came out in droves. Incredible. Except you and me.
Except us. That's amazing. I do want to see Oppenheimer badly. I do. And my wife, I like watched her progression as the media started to take hold. She had zero interest in seeing that movie. And then the more stories she saw, and the more she saw Margot in interviews, and the more she saw critic takes on it. And then all of a sudden she's like, I want to see this movie. She was programmed. Media works. I'm just curious as to how it's going to replicate itself, meaning how other brands decide they're going to leverage mass movies and mass PR machines, and whether there are other brands that can actually do it. And then, to your point, the juxtaposition of those two stories, yet oddly similar in time frame origins, right? Like, the same America, roughly the same time period, made both of these things that this period of time later are coming back together. It's kind of wild.
It's a shame. It's sort of a bittersweet moment for Hollywood. Maybe it's because I'm sitting out here, but you know, you've got this great weekend where these two films open. They're both original stories. One, obviously based on very famous IP, but an original, you know, story. And then you've got Oppenheimer, clearly original story. Both films open huge, you know, in a marketplace that's dominated by IP with Marvel and Indiana Jones and everything else. it was really, really encouraging that these two films opened the way they did. However, the downside of all this is the bitterness of this is that we've got this writers and actors strike that's happening. The writers are 2+ months in and, you know, the actors a couple weeks in, and, you know, based on folks that I've been talking to, it's several months out before this is going to get resolved. I mean, some people say September, some people say October, but it's a shame that you've got this celebratory moment that theaters are finally back. If you want to look at the numbers of the weekend, yet you've got this strike that's hanging, you know, on Monday morning that everybody's still talking about. So it's an interesting time for us. We're going to try to power through that tonight, you and I, and focus on more of the celebratory nature of content and how it's being made today. But any thoughts on the strike before we move on?
It had to happen. And what I mean by that is that at no point beyond today will the writers and actors have more leverage than they do today. Definition of IP is changing at such a rapid rate. Fragmentation of media is, as we all knew and have seen for a long time, is only continuing to be more prominent. And the rise of generative technology is going to cause people to really question whether entertainment needs to come from a human for people to want to participate in it and with it. And knowing those realities, already facing a broken model with streaming, etc., if you are fighting on behalf of the artists and the creators, you have to take your shot at maximizing this collective negotiation as much as humanly possible, and then just cross whatever bridge you need to cross years down the line when this contract is up. But at least at that point, you'll have had enough time to figure out what's happening.
A couple of months ago, you sent me a text, and we haven't had a chance to talk about this text since you sent it to me. We've texted each other since then, but we haven't spoken. So this is literally the first time you and I are talking since you sent me this text. It's one of the classic Neuhauser texts that you have sent me many times over in our relationship. And it's this very text that I've been thinking about for the last couple of months. And it's the catalyst for tonight's episode. So some context for people, and then I'm going to read the text out loud. I didn't ask your permission, but I'm sure you're okay with it.
That's fine.
This text was in response to me texting you about the Ben Affleck film that came out a few months ago about Nike and Air Jordan called Air, which I did enjoy. Didn't love it. Certainly didn't dislike it, but didn't love it. And I think you had seen it first. You had told me, hit me when you see it, and we'll go back and forth, and that's what happened. So I texted you about it, and then we had this exchange. Here's what you wrote me. I would also, on a podcast, which is right now, by the way, calmly and with brotherly love, very nice of you, tell you that your inner critic is finally allowed to lay down its cynicistic flavor of pessimism. I love it. The one that critics are almost forced to embody if and when they are young. You, DC, are now older and wiser. That is true. More well-viewed than the original Dennis Kamlick. You have the experience to know what comes on the other side of opinion developing habits. We have seen enough to know no's are easier. Defending the yes requires much more creativity and love of the art. Yes, people, these are the kinds of texts I get from Lance Neuhauser. And I'm not even done. Hang on. Plus, a thumbs up until proven wrong default gives us the space and freedom to lean more towards the artistic side of optimism. And yes, cynicistic is a made-up form of cynicism. Perhaps a new hobby I may practice in text with you to gently nudge us both to ritualize inner voice kindness, something we all need more of during our time on this planet. Now, look, I'm all about defending the yes tonight. Listen, that's what we're going to do tonight. Lance, beautifully articulated as always, but I'm going to give you the floor to expand, elaborate. Go.
Give a dissertation. I must start by saying that hearing someone read me back to me is an uncomfortable feeling, especially something that came from the privacy of our own chats, but I did call out the use of it on the pod, so it's all fair play and fair game. So I'm excited to be here. Thank you for having me again. once a year is probably all you can handle. And I think it's a wonderful ritual. You and I have been in business for a long time, and you and I are both people who pour our hearts into the work that we do. Not everyone is like that. Not everyone needs to be like that. But you and I are kindred spirits in that capacity.
I agree.
And when you're in business, willing to put your heart on the table time and time again, your heart is going to get stomped on, and it's going to feel like your ass was kicked over and over and over again. And what I've come to realize is that business oftentimes resembles life, and life oftentimes resembles business. And in this case, I feel like they both resemble one another. That taking the positive side of what's going on, the grateful side of what's going on, can be as infectious as someone who takes the negative side of things. And over the course of my years, I've found that we go further when we give, yes, the benefit of the doubt, until you prove you can no longer say yes. As opposed to, I'm going to say no until someone proves to me as to why I should say yes. And in the middle of, you know, there's optimism, there's pessimism, you know, in the middle is realism or pragmatism, if that's a thing. I kind of look at this systematically, that people think the artist and the critic are opposing forces. I actually think they're symbiotic. Okay. And so if you plot this kind of as a grid, I'm gonna dork out for a second. You know, you plot it systematically, you will have critical optimism, artist optimism, critical pessimism, and the artist's pessimism.
Yep.
Because there's symbiotic two sides of every relationship. And so if you want to really look at optimism and pessimism through the lens of an artist and critic, we should lay these out in the standard 2x2 grid. Well, when you look at the critical optimism, to me, that's the practitioner. That is someone who dedicates themselves to the work that is required to give yes the benefit of the doubt. As I'm told, it is part of our DNA to have fear, to have doubt, and to have uncertainty so that we can run away from risk. So in order to have critical optimism, you have to practice that. The other quadrant would be artist's optimism. These are the, you know, to quote my man, these are the dreamer of dreams. These are the music makers, right?
Yep.
You go to the pessimistic side and you have critical pessimism. And I see that as the seeker. This is someone who practices the art of finding reasons to be pessimistic. And the artist pessimism is oftentimes the pain that they have with exposing their vulnerabilities to the world. And oftentimes you hear of artists feeling as though that they are not good enough, and their work isn't good enough, and they are defined by their work, as opposed to them being, you know, their work just being a byproduct of who they are. And seeking is good, right? Getting back to that critical pessimism, seeking is good. It's great, actually. It's the start. You know, and as a critic and as an artist, both methods they're both methods for bringing people along with you. Being a critic is trying to bring people along with their point of view. Being an artist is trying to bring someone along with you to make you oftentimes feel something, experience something. And so the question is, as a critic and as an artist, on what journey are we trying to bring people along with us? are we trying to bring them on a journey to find nose, or on a journey to find yeses?
And do you think, prior to the text, do you think that you and I were on this journey of nose? And I mean, clearly the way I interpreted what you sent me was that you certainly want to pivot towards the optimistic side, the yeses. And it's funny, I actually do as well, but I don't think that you think of me that way. And we're going to make this personal in a second. We got to bring it back to the two of us. But, cause you have called me a curmudgeon more than once in our relationship. I've known you for 14 something years, and you have definitely called me a curmudgeon. You've probably called me a curmudgeon in the last 6 months.
I'm sure I have.
I would also say that there's partial truth to that. It's not that I want to be, but it's easy to be.
It is easy. So you used a key word. I'll get to us in a second. On some levels, you need both. You need the critic and you need the artist. You need the optimism, you need the pessimism. I've often said as a leader in business that finding no's are clarifying, and clarity is what we seek. But it is much harder. You said it's easy, right? It's much harder to find the persistent yes, the reliant yes, the practiced, tried, and true yes. That is not easy to do. I call you a curmudgeon, and you said it's partially true in one area. I call you a curmudgeon because I know it's an exposed button, and every time I push it, it evokes a reaction.
That's what you like to do to me.
Right. And sometimes I just like stirring you out of your normal, how's Dennis Kamlick doing? He's somewhere between a 4 and a 6, right? That's usually where you play. It's very rare to get Dennis at a 9 or a 10. And it's rare to get Dennis at a 0 or 1. You're usually a pretty even keel guy. But I feel like I have had the pleasure of seeing you outside of the 4 to 6 range. And so sometimes I like to try and push you out of the 4 to 6 range so that I can bring that Dennis to the surface. But it usually only happens when it comes to art, and specifically film and TV.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to make the claim now. I know you were a critic when you were young, and I know that it is a lot easier. In fact, I'm going to quote a study that I won't be able to reference the exact study, but I know there was a study that went on to show that critics who pan movies more than they like movies are actually more well-liked critics. They have longer, more successful careers. Now, you were a critic early on. You had some local, as I understand it, relative success. And I think you found a voice for how you view art that solidified. And you and I, pre this conversation, we're talking about the differences between ourselves at one age versus another and how we've evolved as human beings. I would expect, I would hope, I dream to see your critique of art and film move to one where you are a consistent defender of the yes, because you're so astute with film and television. You have such a keen eye that if you helped others understand why some of this art was as good as it is, points that are oftentimes missed by people who don't study it the way that you do, then it could open people's eyes to appreciate art more broadly and more art broadly.
My resolution going into 23 was I'm going to go back and study and revisit the films of the 60s and 70s. So, and that's like, it's basically my own curriculum. I've read numerous books. I'm still reading some of those books right now. Deep dive on the 60s, deep dive on the 70s. I'm watching a lot of the films or rewatching a lot of the films. Some of these are films that I've never seen before, and movies I've seen for the first time. Others I've clearly seen previously, but under, through a different lens, revisiting them through my older eyes. And I will tell you, like, I'm blown away. And it's been an absolute joy for the first 6 months of this year doing what I've been doing. I'm reading about it every night. I'm like, I'm literally going all in. Like, it's been a lot of fun. I force myself to watch at least one film from one of those decades every week. And again, like, I have a whole list on my phone. And in love with the films from those two decades. So much so that I often say to people, like, I wish I was 35 or like 40 in the 70s, or maybe even younger, so that I can could have like gone out and seen all these films in the theater, because it would have been bonkers to be able to go to the theater and see Jaws or One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest or Easy Rider, all these films that are obviously prominent from the time. The challenge with that, Lance, so that's the yes, right? That's the optimism, because I've relished this class that I've put myself through. The challenge with it is that it's hard not to then compare to what's being made today.
This is where I was going. You think
perfect. Let's do it.
I'm so excited. You think going back to the 60s and the 70s and revisiting those films is a proper curriculum in order to arrive at potential optimism around art? I don't think so. I think you need to be able to go to a film today that makes a ton of money, like Barbie, and be able to watch it and appreciate it for what it is.
Lance.
Can you go to a Barbie and actually walk out and say, that was a good film because context, the lens mattered, and when you looked at it through a specific lens, you could say that it was good?
I absolutely can do that. Now, I haven't seen Barbie yet, and I plan to see Barbie. It's not a film that would normally come to mind for me to go see, but I do want to see it.
It's got your boy Gosling from Driver in there, doesn't it?
There he is. It's a great film. I saw Mission Impossible last weekend, opening weekend. It was last weekend. I saw it in IMAX. I'm a fan of the franchise. I don't love all of them, but I've enjoyed most of them, okay? I've enjoyed most of them, Lance. And I would say 20 minutes into the new film, Dead Reckoning Part 1, I was just sitting there and I had a smile on my face. And I think I even texted you this later the next day. And I just said, I saw Mission Impossible yesterday. I thought the movie was outstanding.
We have different barometers here. Mission Impossible is not the barometer of what would, in my eye, what would be a considered...
Barbie's not the barometer either.
You might be right, but Mission Impossible, the franchise, is one of the best action franchises to be put out. And so through that lens, they are enjoyable movies. Here's a question for you.
Let's have it.
Can you watch bad movies or television and enjoy them as bad movies and television? And I don't mean so bad they're good. I mean the legit bad movies and television. Can you watch them and enjoy them for the fact that they are bad?
Why would I want to watch something that I think is going to be bad? Listen, I'm watching some of that stuff right now. Here's a good example. I am watching what I would call a bad show on Apple TV Plus. It's called Hijack. You know, I saw all the marketing. It's a lot of it out here. I saw it and like, all right, I'll watch that. I like him. He's very likable. Okay. The show is not good. It is, I'm six episodes in or five deep, half of it, right? And it's stupid. It's just stupid. And I still watch it. I get my alert on my phone every freaking Wednesday. A new episode of Hijack is now available. And I will watch it the following weekend. It's very by the numbers, right? Is it well made and is it expensive and is good production values? Of course, absolutely. It's not good. Why am I still watching it? Why did I just do an episode with my brother and Jason and Malone last month about good, bad movies? We talked about nothing but crap for 2 hours and how much we love it.
Based off of how much movie and film you watch, would you consider yourself an optimist when it comes to watching film and television? That you go into it expecting to like it? Do you go into it expecting not to like it? Or do you literally go in completely neutral without the context, without the lens mattering at all, right? Like if you go into the theater having a big bucket of popcorn and a soda of some sort in the theater experience, that in and of itself is going to kick you toward, it's supposed to kick you toward optimism and liking the film versus just watching something on your phone or watching something on your television at home. Can you walk in completely neutral, or do you walk in pessimistically, or do you walk in optimistically?
I would love to go in neutral and just experience the film for what it is. No preconceived notions, right? I went into Mission Impossible going back to what you said, echoing what you just said about Mission Impossible, huge franchise, Christopher McQuarrie, you know, Tom Cruise, he's going to give you a good film, right? And so I went in with this expectation that I'm probably going to like Mission Impossible. On the other side of that, I went into Indiana Jones literally the week before that or 2 weeks before that, not excited about it because I had read some of the chatter coming out of its premiere at Cannes and it wasn't good. And Spielberg didn't direct it. I didn't think we needed it. I didn't like the fourth one. Certainly didn't need a fifth one. And so I went in. But again, like I told my brother, I'm going in low expectations. So like, but it didn't take much for me to not like it either. So it's hard. Like but then, you know, we didn't talk about Asteroid City and you and I'm not even sure if you've seen it.
I watched it. Yes. I watched it in prep for this podcast. I'm like, how can I come onto the podcast without having seen the latest Wes Anderson film?
Asteroid City is probably the closest I would have been to neutral as of late, where I went to go see a movie, hadn't read much about it, didn't know much about it, saw the trailer, what have you. And I went in, saw it opening weekend, and I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know much about it. Now, I didn't like it at all. I thought it was a miss, and he doesn't make many misses.
What did he miss on? Okay, let's put aside from the fact that you and I almost always agree to a degree, and it's the last twist of the knob that causes us to have these conversations. I would rank this as one of the lowest Wes Anderson films that I've seen as well. So let's just get past that, okay?
Yep.
But the question is, what did he miss on? You said it was a miss, okay? There was incredibly artistic cinematography.
Totally.
Okay, so hold on. I'm building a point.
Yep.
There was phenomenal acting. There was great dialogue. There were great backdrops created for the scene. I still don't understand the plot. The first 20 minutes of the first 20...
You're answering your own question.
I know. It was incredibly self-indulgent. My point was showing, though, that it's... You can't... This is blanket pessimism. You cannot say that it was a miss when he didn't miss on all of the elements of the art itself. The art is so multidimensional, and he is so good at certain things and did some of those things so well that obviously there was something to appreciate, some beauty from that movie that is worth calling out before potentially even saying, it was a miss.
Because that's how we're wired.
That's how you're wired.
At the end of the day, people come out, what did you do this weekend? I saw Asteroid City. Oh, yeah. So how was that? You have to answer the question, okay? Could I have just gone through a 5-minute overview to that person at the water cooler and say, this is what I thought of Asteroid City? Yes. Production design, incredible. Cinematography, incredible. Great music. It was really well shot. All that. Don't disagree with any of that. Some of the performances, Tom Hanks aside, I don't think Hanks was good at all. But I thought some people were really good in it.
Too out of his lane.
But I think if I had to boil it down, is I didn't care. I just didn't care. There was no joy. I mean, did you think there was joy in that movie?
I found joy in that movie 100% because how many hours do I have in my life? How many hours of original Wes Anderson footage do I actually get to see? Okay. So for an hour and a half or hour and 40 minutes or whatever it was, I got to see new imagery, new character creation, new ways to shoot shots, although he's obviously in his lane and he's got a very Wes Anderson feel to him. Not to ruin anything for anyone, but there's a scene that had two characters standing on balconies at the end.
Yep.
That was so beautifully shot that at some point I was just so into seeing the art on screen that it was bringing me joy, and more joy than to the point you were making earlier. I think it was a valid point that why would I watch things that didn't have that kind of art and beauty in it if I didn't have to, if you can find that level of art and beauty within a lot of art and beauty. So a critic oftentimes has to condense their feedback into, it was a miss. Whereas if you want to take someone on a journey, someone with your skill set, someone with your understanding of film, perhaps that person at the water cooler that you just called out could actually use a little bit explanation as to how to view Wes Anderson films in details, and then be able to, if you see them connect, that's set design, or if you see them connect to the point that you make around cinematography, then you, Dennis Kamlick, can be a guide to say, well, if you like that, let me give you another movie to watch that has both an incredible cinematographer, but also a wonderful plot line that you might like more than Asteroid City. And I would argue that given how much you've studied, it's almost your responsibility to start to pass that along to the people in your lives. And you almost have to be the critical optimist, the practitioner, and show people the skills that you have developed.
To what you just said is the very reason I'm doing the podcast. I'm going to each episode revisit a work of art that is either inspiring to me or something that's resonated with me so deeply that I want to talk about it for an hour or an hour and a half with somebody. And, you know, it's funny, like I never thought that that was what I was going to end up turning into, but that's what it was. But if you go back to everything that I've done in my career, when I was a kid, I wrote movie reviews when I was little. That formed into writing real movie reviews at the school paper. And then I turned that into a career in entertainment marketing. So I've been in this space since I was like, you know, 15 years old. And the podcast is like the perfect place for me to be now. Like I love every episode. I love bringing on one of my friends or multiple people. And we sit back and talk about why that movie is amazing. You know, the optimism, the, you know, the appreciation, the celebration of a film. I just did Coming to America last week. I just published that episode a couple of days ago. And like my brother wrote this lovely post on Facebook the other day. I won't read it now, but just, you know, he just boiled it down into two sentences about why he loves spending his Saturday morning listening to me and my buddy Dave talk about Prince Akeem for an hour and a half. Like that is why I'm doing the podcast, Lance. It's going back to, maybe I'm not quite there, but I'd like to get into that critical optimism top left quadrant, if at all possible. Maybe not quite there yet, but I aspire to be that. And that's what the pod's for.
The one thing that is pretty fantastic is that in your episodes, you do show unbelievable love and appreciation for the movies that you are covering off on. And I love the change in direction that the podcast has taken. Not that talking, I mean, you're a very a good interviewer, and you evoke emotion from other people, and getting to their stories is wonderful. But your love of TV and film is infectious. It's infectious. And your knowledge of it is so deep relative to other people who love film and TV. And you have this multi-dimensional, multifaceted lens by which you see film and television because of being a fan, because of being a critic, because of being an artist, putting out your art yourself with the podcast, and then the business side of it. It puts you in such great position to appreciate the art and film that I just, for you, from my heart to yours, want you to not be reductionist on things that you do find joy from by saying a movie like Asteroid City is just a miss and that you do wax a little bit more poetically about the beauty that you, Dennis Kamlick, saw in the movie. And then also, yes, what you didn't see from the movie that you hope to see again in another movie and that you've seen from other movies as well.
Your point is noted. I hear you. I appreciate the wonderful feedback about the podcast that you just said. And it's funny, like some people, after they listen to every episode, they send me a text. My brother sends me a text. A couple of other friends send me texts. And it makes my day when I get that feedback. Not because I'm hearing good things about my show. It's more about that my show connected with them in some capacity. And these are the things that they liked about it. And that just, man, that shit makes my day, Lance. It's funny. I've been doing this show for 2.5 years. And I'm only now, literally now, feeling like I'm just finding my voice with it and the groove. And it's a really comfortable place to be. And I'm going to keep doing it.
Do you think this is below you or something?
Man, I think I'm 45 years old polishing forks.
No one is asking you to be here. I don't think anybody remembers your name.
Nice try. You think I don't know how hard it is hiring people since COVID?
We don't have that problem.
You really drink this Kool-Aid, huh?
Yeah, I do.
Why?
Because I love this, Richie. I love this so much, dude. Did you know that when this restaurant opened 12 years ago, it won the best restaurant in the world the same year? It's retained 3 stars because we have a waiting list that's long. 5,000 people waiting at any given moment long. Do you see their faces when they walk in here? How stoked they are to see us and how stoked we have to be to serve them? It takes 200 people to keep this place in orbit. And at any given moment, one of those people that is waiting in line gets to eat here. They get to spend their time and their money here. I'm sorry, bro, but we need to have some forks without streaks in them. Every day here is the freaking Super Bowl. You don't have to drink the Kool-Aid, Richie. I just need you to respect me. I need you to respect the staff. I need you to respect the diners. And I need you to respect yourself.
I can do respect.
Lovely. I'll see you inside.
Have you ever experienced a work of art? It could be a movie. It could be a TV show. It could be a painting. It could be a record. I know you're a music guy. And in a near instant, you are so blown away by it. You're so impressed by its creativity, its creative excellence, the impact it made on you, that you actually think that this work was specifically made for you. Do you think like that? And you have examples of that?
I think like that, of course. It has been experienced in a multitude of ways, down to I've been at concerts where a band has played a specific song and I felt like cosmically we were all put here in this moment for me to hear that song, right? Like at that moment in time. I was in Amsterdam traveling after having graduated college for a couple months doing the Eurorail and scratching together as much scratch as possible to stay on the trip as long as I could. I was in Amsterdam and I went to the Van Gogh Museum, and I always thought that Van Gogh's art was cool. Mm-hmm. I didn't know why. I just thought it looked cool. I didn't think much of it. I was a young kid. I mean, I was 22 when I was there. My interactions with paintings and art were limited at that point. I didn't pay it too much mind. And I was in no rush. I was a traveler. I wasn't a tourist. I was just sitting in the museum with my buddy for a while. He took one room. I think he was doing some writing in one of the rooms and I was sitting there. I'm in Van Gogh's bedroom. Like I'm in his bedroom. He didn't create that art for me, but I felt in that moment that I knew what Van Gogh was feeling and thinking while he was in that room painting that picture.
Yep.
I felt like I had those feelings and those thoughts in my own room. And I felt like I had transcended place and time and connected into this collective consciousness to where I was again inside his mind. I know it sounds crazy and it was Amsterdam, so you know there was some help, but it was I really did feel that. And I'll give you a recent example, and I don't say this just because you know you gave me a little bit of prep into this episode, but the most recent artistic expression that I felt that way is there are so many scenes and full episodes of The Bear that has made me feel like this show at this moment was put here right now for me to watch it and for me to experience it and connect through the art to myself in a way that I couldn't without the art as a medium in connecting to myself, whether it be too painful or too out of reach for whatever mental reason, the art in and of itself almost acted as the therapist for me to learn about myself in a way that I needed to advance my thinking and my feeling.
It's amazing how connected you and I are. It's honestly, I'm not even joking. It's sort of staggering. I forget what word you used earlier. Maybe it was before we started recording. You said something about maybe there were kindred spirits. I think that's what you said. Watching The Bear last season, I had that same kind of reaction. Like, this show is pretty phenomenal. I loved it instantaneously. But this season, season two, which just launched about a month ago, a lot of people have already watched it. I hope you watched it. And if you haven't watched it, you might want to stop listening now because we're going to get into spoiler territory pretty soon. But I was like, I'm sort of like almost couldn't even articulate the level of excellence that I think that show brings to the table and connects to me personally in a way that is rarely something I've experienced. Like there's been a few albums or bands that have done that for me. Certainly a couple other movies that have done that for me, but The Bear is the first show that I can think of in quite a long time, TV show that has absolutely blown me away. Like when I finished watching it, season two, and I watched it literally in like 12 hours, I just blew through them. Didn't do it all in one night, but I did it in like two nights. I honestly wanted to open up the window and just fucking yell out to the street. Like, this show is so good. It's hard to put into words.
I watched a lot of The Bear. My wife goes to sleep earlier than me. So I watched some things on my phone. Okay. I watched a lot of The Bear, a lot. Tucked under the covers, effectively, me no more than 9 inches away from my screen, watching this outpouring of emotion and music and dialogue and expressions, that because I was holding it so close to me physically, it really did feel like I was connecting to it beyond just mentally, almost into a visceral physical connection. And you juxtapose that. So I ended up watching not to bash Asteroid City, but I ended up watching Asteroid City on an iPad. Okay. And I knew right away, I'm like, there's no possible way I'm going to enjoy this film as much as this film was meant to be enjoyed.
Sure.
This, I needed to get the bucket of popcorn. I needed to go into the theater. I needed to see the cinematography on the big screen. I needed to see that. And so, coming into this, I did want to know the context in which you spent that weekend or those two nights watching The Bear, and whether you think the art is as good as you feel it to be today, regardless of whether you would have seen it potentially 6 months earlier or 6 months later with a different context in your life and a different context to how you were watching it, where you were watching it, et cetera. Do you think the art itself holds up, or, you know, some art is meant to be literal, but some art is also meant to be abstract? Do you think the abstract nature of what was created would have grabbed you regardless?
Yeah, I do. I know where you're going with that. I think it's a really interesting way to look at it. I think breaking it up into sort of two pieces there, and I think that's what makes a show like this a masterpiece, or a modern masterpiece, is that it both of those threads connect in two different ways. So what I mean by that is you've got the artistic side of it, the everything from the direction to the vision to the screenwriting to cinematography, production values, the acting, obviously, the music, which is, you could do a whole podcast on. Maybe you should. That stuff is, it's literally just like first rate across the board. And we're going to geek out in a minute on all of that. But then what I think is that rare thing is when you get pulled into story, you get pulled into character, you get pulled into themes. And there are some very, very clear themes that happened in season two of The Bear that speak to me personally in a very profound way. And I think, you know, going back to, you said something about, you know, where are you in that state of your life and what are you going through at that moment in time? Might be different now versus what it would have been if you watched it a year ago or 6 months ago, right? And I hear you on that. What I have gone through personally in my life the last 7 years has been hard, really hard. And you find out what you're made of. You find out how strong you can be, you know, going through an unexpected divorce or losing a job that you really liked. We all had to go through COVID, but a relocation and then going through, the death of your parents back to back in 3 months. These are no small things. I mean, this is life. Life's hard. And we all have our things. You've gone through yours too. I know you. I know you well. And I know what you've been through. And I would imagine you can relate to that, this show, probably for very similar reasons like I have. Some of the themes in The Bear just speak to me personally, just given some of those things that I just mentioned that I've gone through. It's sort of like there was a scene at the end of episode 7. It's that scene where Richie, who's without a doubt my favorite character on the show, they sent Richie away for a week to go learn how to stage at what is considered, I guess, the best restaurant in the world, as they put it in the episode. But he's in that kitchen at the end with Chef Terry, and she's peeling mushrooms. And she says, "It's never too late to start over." And I started crying right on the spot. Like, out of nowhere, I was in a perfectly good headspace. I was thoroughly enjoying The Bear. And it just brought me out of my element for a minute. And I had to hit pause and I had to kind of just take a beat, appreciate what I just heard, brought it back to myself.
Your listeners are going to start to call some bullshit, but I'm now going to say that I can't believe how aligned we are. Before we got on the podcast, we did, you know, just a little catch up. And, you know, to follow in your footsteps, I have gone through quite a bit as well, as you mentioned, a recent startling loss, someone close to me taking their own life, and a series of startling deaths over the past few years, like you.
Yep.
And I said to you before we got on this pod that a week and a half ago, I had what felt like a moment of clarity, a breakthrough. Mm-hmm. And what I didn't tell you that I did the night before that breakthrough was that I rewatched the entire season 2 with my wife.
Nice.
And the night before I had the breakthrough was the night that the two of us watched episode 7.
Okay.
And that transformation, we saw this character for a season and a half who, I don't know, I mean, I can't even describe it either, but through his human complexity caused me to want more for him for a season and a half. And the way that transformation was delivered, even though it felt like this very quick transformation, it felt like it was always in him as a character. It was always ready to come out. That is what I think I related to so much, that sometimes in life, you just hit the tipping point. You just get the moment that causes everything to change. And to witness that in such a beautiful and honest and unforced way, that had follow-up lines like, you know, I wear suits now. You wear suits now. Yeah. Why do you wear suits? Well, it's because I feel better about myself when I wear them. The honesty and the integrity by which the show handled vulnerability was able to help me find some of that in my own self. And that's not often for a TV show to be able to do that.
She got pulled out of the room. So he's in there by himself, and she didn't finish her story about her father, and he chased her out, but she left and he couldn't get her. And he comes back towards the camera, and then he stops and he turns right, and you see the every second counts sign under the clock. If that scene and that episode doesn't bring out something inside you, man, I feel bad for you. Probably one of the most profound sequences I have seen in a TV show in the last, I couldn't even tell you how many years.
I thought there was a brilliant setup scene in that episode, which was the call that he had with his ex-wife.
Yeah, it's gut-wrenching.
Gut-wrenching. And yet he said every right thing.
He did.
To the benefit of his ex-wife and daughter, he put himself aside and did everything right, that he was capable of stepping into being the right person as long as he just allowed himself to be that person, that he didn't get in his own way, that he just cleared the space for it.
I mean, it plays out in the scene when he goes in and talks to Natalie, and he basically apologizes, you know, for how he's been. And he's sort of referencing the behavior that we all see of Richie in season one, and certainly maybe even early parts of season two. But, you know, being sent away for a week, which he thought was a punishment, ended up being the very best thing that could have happened to him. And he didn't see it at the time, but we all saw it coming. I mean, it all plays out beautifully in, you know, the sequence when, you know, he remembered that the woman that was at the table with her family didn't get deep dish pizza while she was in Chicago, and she was bummed that she didn't get it. Richie makes a mental note. He goes back in. They send him out to go get a deep dish. He gets it. He sees the chef turn this pizza into something spectacular.
Micro basil.
Fuck yeah. So great. The joy of watching Richie not only ask if he can take the pizza out to the dining room, which they let him do, and then he does it.
And how natural and excited, without being overly excited, to the table when he delivered it. It was wonderful.
Chef, can I bring it to the table?
Go get him, Richie.
Thank you, Chef.
Walking add-on on table 9?
Chef!
All right, look alive, team. Almost there, just another 7 courses. I know you guys have probably waited a very long time to be here. Thank you. But I couldn't live with myself if I let this beautiful family leave Chicago without sampling one of my personal favorite dishes, Pequod's deep dish.
No. Oh, you did not hear me say that.
Mind you, baby.
Oh, my God, you all are wonderful.
No, stop it. You're wonderful. You guys got any drinks?
I can't believe this.
That old fashioned's not going to drink itself. You guys want some Bacardi and diet? A little B&D? Should I send some over? Enjoy, guys.
The juxtaposition of season 2, episode 6 to season 2, episode 7, the holiday episode, those two episodes back to back are what did it for me. The combination of those two, I really felt were the peak of the Bear. Not saying that I really liked how the season progressed in episodes 8, 9, and 10 of season 2, but those two episodes, 6 and 7, are like the, you know, the home run tracks on an album that makes, you know, it's what makes Sgt. Pepper's Sgt. Pepper's. Yes, not every song can be Sgt. Pepper's itself, but the rest of the songs need to be incredible for the album to still be Sgt. Pepper's.
Sure.
Episodes, you know, episodes 6 and 7, that's what this was, right?
Yeah.
Can I continue to bash Asteroid City for one more second? You know, because you have a show in the Bear that created this human complexity with these storylines and the dialogue By the way, to be an actor on The Bear with the type of soliloquies that are provided is absolutely extraordinary. My wife watched it, and she was a former actress herself. She's like, everyone who's going in for an interview right now, everyone who's getting a call is pulling out a scene, some dialogue totally. From The Bear, and they are ripping it, because you had like 8 minute dialogue to open a scene when The Bear is at support group for his brother, and he's just telling the story. I mean, it was literally an 8 minute opening, just a soliloquy. But you have this extraordinary human complexity without having to go into great detail about the backdrops of the characters. So much so that you wait till episode 6 of season 2 before you even see some of these people.
Yep.
Whereas in Asteroid City, he took like literally, I timed it, 23 minutes at the beginning to just talk about everyone's backstory and show them and be indulgent. And I was just, and I did see these two in this moment as so diabolically opposed, one landing with me and one not, probably because of the subtleties and the complexities and the unexpected human connection that happened. Whereas, you know, to the one that tried to set up this connection to the characters, Asteroid City, I never really got connected to him.
I'm so glad that you loved The Bear season 2, because you and I admittedly have not spoken about it. I knew that you were going to watch
it. We have not.
You texted me when you finished. I knew that. I knew you were done, but I didn't ask you if you liked it. You didn't ask me if I liked it. We purposely didn't go there, as we knew we were going to do this. And I would have been so disappointed tonight, and this would have been a very different episode tonight if you didn't like season 2. A show like The Bear in season 1, right? It did really well last summer. I mean, I wouldn't say that it was a massive hit, but it was definitely, if you were in the know, it was a show that you liked. You and I had texted each other. You asked me if I had seen it. You told me you know where it films, and you don't live far from there.
I think I owe people a full disclosure, though, right? Like, I lived across the street from The Beef. I worked across the street. So I worked on the same actual physical block as where I lived. My building was just the one that was back to back to the one I worked and lived at. And I had to go around the block, and every day going to work and going home, walking through that, I passed The Beef and ate lunch almost every day next door at the Green Door Tavern, which they reference in the show. And I, you know, Lynn Bramer is a DJ. You want to go back to your question? Rest in peace, who just passed away recently. Lynn Bramer on Fridays used to say these lines. He used to say, it's great to be alive. And he would say, it's Lynn Bramer, your best friend in the whole wide world. And his music selections that he played almost always felt like they were specifically for me. When I was listening to him, I'm in my 20s. I'm living in Chicago. Felt like I had outgrown the city, but never outgrew my closest friends and family, and felt tied to them, but wanted to go spread my wings. And I was in this kind of really tough place. I was fighting depression quite a bit, and I was going to a job. This was the early 20s, before I had ever started a company, and I dreaded getting out of bed in the morning. And one of my favorite parts of my day would be my 30-minute drive, where I would get a chance to listen to Lynn Bramer, and he would remind me that it was great to be alive. And he made me feel like he was my best friend in the whole wide world at a moment that I needed a friend, and not the friends that were my best friends, but a friend who could just play the right piece of music and touch me in my soul the way that I needed to be touched at the moment that I needed that. And he did this for years for me. And again, he recently passed, but in season one, they used Lynn.
Did they?
And yeah, and they used him saying that your best friend in the whole wide world. I think that was one of the two lines they used. They used one of the two. I think that was the one they used. And I was just off and running. I felt like, and then they're playing all the music I listened to in the 90s and using it in these new, fresh ways for me to connect through the music to myself again, nostalgically, but to myself, how I am today. I'm bringing my old self to meet my new self and reconcile some of the feelings that I'd been grappling with for a long time that now as a result of my daughter and my wife, I've been able to start to let down and through actually these passings that I've just experienced have had to come to grips with. And all the while I'm getting to immerse myself into this show that feels like it's a companion on the journey and someone who's also pulling me along when I didn't have the energy or the words or the visuals to do it myself. And so I grew up around the corner from Pequods, right? Like when they use Pequods, I mean, like everything they were saying felt like it was speaking to me. And so someone who wasn't from Chicago to hear them speak about this the way that you have, I was like, okay, so this isn't just, you know, a Chicago folks that grew up around here. This isn't just me who lived right there, worked, you know, right there that was into this. It was so beautiful to know that it was yet another thing for you and I to connect on and what seemingly a whole bunch of people who are saying, yes, chef, the meme, are connecting on as well.
I remember texting you last summer, a year ago, when I was watching season one, and because I know you're a Wilco guy and obviously Chicago guys and like, you know, they played Impossible Germany in one of the episodes in season one, right?
Of all the songs.
Fucking songs. It's Impossible Germany, right? It's like those decisions, those little details, those little decisions, and there's a million of them in The Bear. And like, and then this season, right? You jump to season two, and it's literally the first episode in season two. They play Bruce Hornsby in like the first 2 minutes, and then they play Wilco. And I think it was Handshake Drugs. Again, like, fuck you guys for playing Wilco. And that's me complimenting a show. It's like when I do that, when I'll be watching it, right? And I hear them play Handshake Drugs by Wilco, right? I'll be like, I'll literally hit pause and I'll be like, fuck you guys for playing that. And that's like Dennis Kamlick giving you the best compliment that I can give you. Cause it's like, I see what you're doing now. Not everybody is going to see that, right? I know my buddy Lance Neuhauser is going to see it because he loves Wilco. And I love Wilco. Cosolino loves Wilco. We're all going to get that, right? But like, that's going to go over the head of somebody else that has no idea what that song is. And then in episode 10, Lance, we're jumping all over the place. Episode 10, which is called The Bear, which was when they opened the restaurant, their big night, friends and family. And when things are getting, it was in the back half an hour of that episode, it's getting chaotic in the kitchen. It was before Carmi gets locked in the fridge, but they played Wilco again. I'm not sure if you picked up on this. They played Spiders, Kid Smoke, again, from Ghost Is Born. And it's that song that's got that repetition and that beat. And you're like, fuck you guys for playing this again. Like, I would love to meet Christopher Storr, the showrunner, the creator of The Bear, and buy the guy a couple of drinks at a bar. You could sit with me, Lance, and like talk about the music cues that they put in that show. It's phenomenal. And I've never seen another show ever do that to that extent.
So I put Spiders on my July 23 playlist.
Of course.
Right? If you so we've talked about this before. I've made a playlist on Spotify. It's verifiable. Every month since October 2010. And I put songs that I hear throughout the month on that playlist. And it's effectively become the soundtrack of my life. I can't remember all the songs, obviously, but a lot of the songs that I go back and listen to, I know exactly where I was, why I put it on that playlist, etc. And if you look at my June and July of 23 playlists, I think I put the whole, I mean, at some point, it's almost the whole soundtrack from the show from season two is on, because each scene that they use that music hit me so hard that I was like, I'm remembering this moment. the freakouts from the intensity, season one where they turn on the online ordering and he gets in Sid's face, which causes her to leave. Obviously, that type of internal stress, that type of loss of regulation, self-regulation, is something that I can relate to with a great degree of connectivity. And then to watch him go on the journey to be not shitty, to be a person that can rub his heart,
yeah,
and reconnect to himself and to whoever he's with, so that he can ground himself and be kind and compassionate and loving, is beautiful. And we haven't talked about the dialogue all that much, but I know a lot of this is coming straight from the actual restaurant world that I only was peripherally connected to for a few years. I have started to use some of the language from The Bear in my everyday life. Like, to be able to tell someone heard is more powerful to me than just saying like, yeah, I got it.
Yeah.
I understand. I heard you, heard chef. To be able to just, I did this with my wife. I did the heart rub over the chest. It's happening regularly. And I don't know if you've started to connect with some of those sayings as well, or if you've started to deploy them, but when I've used them and people have seen the show, it has made them light up as well and excited to bring some of the vernacular into their life too.
Season one, breakout hit for sure, right? Did well. Definitely, if you were in the know, you certainly watched it last summer. People were talking about it. And then, you know, you had to wait, right? And then, you know, you knew season two was going to come out this summer. I was anxiously waiting for it. I had the date marked down. I knew that end of June is when it was coming. But, you know, going back to kind of what we talked about earlier in this pod about the optimism, and obviously I was, you know, super optimistic about the next season. However, when a show like this comes back and, you know, you've got some big shoes to fill when you're the showrunner of season two of The Bear, knowing that everybody loved it, it was critically acclaimed. Now you're like, this is like big time, baby. You're coming in hot, summer of 23, and like people are ready for The Bear. And I was really curious. Like, I was curious what they were going to do with it, if it was going to be a departure. And, you know, and I, so freaking grateful that they actually, in my opinion, exceeded the excellence of season one. And season one was an excellent season of television. But I thought this season, the choices they made, the changes they made, the departures they made, particularly, there's a couple of things they really did differently. The character development, they spent a lot of time with the characters. A lot of characters got their own
episodes,
standalone episode, right? You know, a lot. I mean, sending Marcus to Copenhagen and Sydney's tour of Chicago, taste of Chicago, I should say. You know, Richie and the episode we just talked about. And I also feel like they took their time this season. I think there was still the intensity. There was definitely still the anxiety that comes in the kitchen. That's evident. And obviously the episode on the Christmas dinner with the family, but also the finale. But I also feel like the season took a breath, and I think it took a beat. And I think the overall pace of all 10 episodes was a little bit slower, a little bit more measured, and I think it was better for it.
I couldn't agree with you more. The restraint that's shown in that show, you know, B.B. King, I think it was B.B. King who said it's the notes that you don't play that mean more than the notes that you do play. And by feeling like they don't have to put all of the stars in every episode, that they don't have to create this dramatic intensity in each of the scenes in order to get people to like it and feel it. To put Impossible Germany, which I think is like a six minute song, 5 minute song, something like that, and play the whole episode, you know, the whole song in the background.
Yep.
And be okay with it. And to be okay saying, oh, well, there's, you know, three Wilco songs that I'm gonna put in this soundtrack and break that rule and be confident enough in one's own choices that this just works.
Three different versions of the same REM song throughout this season.
Oh, Strange Frequencies.
Yes.
Yeah. It sets us up for some wonderful experiences if and when the show is to return following the strike. But this might be a question that might break some of our agreement streak, or might break the agreement streak. What are your expectations for the show moving forward? Can you go in on the optimistic side of what's going to happen for the Bear in season three? Or are you seeking critical reasons to say that season three doesn't live up to season two, which it can't? I mean, the type of experiences that we're talking about having with, especially episode seven, you said it yourself. That's, you can't even remember the last time it happened. So to expect it twice from one show is unfair. To expect the same level of thought around music and I think it was episode seven in season one where it was filmed as one long continuous shot, to take those types of chances, to give the characters, as you said, full episodes so that you could build them out, to delay dropping certain incredibly helpful points just because you don't need them yet. Yeah. I expect all of that. That doesn't mean it's going to create this type of same moment that can be matched from season two. And so does that mean... you specifically, does that mean you come in pessimistic or optimistic or just ready to appreciate the art perhaps?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think for me on the Bear specifically, I would say optimistic. And here's why I would say that. I think, and I don't think this applies for most shows. And one, you were talking a little earlier about some of the Wilco songs and how they put an 8 minute song in there. And I think that gets back to, and I got to give FX some props here, as FX is the TV brand that produces The Bear. It's on Hulu, but they have a partnership. A smart TV production development executive is going to get out of the way, right? And I think what's brilliant about The Bear is, and you and I talked about this, and we'll get into some of these things. We've already started covering a lot of it, but like what I think is the best thing about The Bear, and there's many things, is that it's the work of, it's a singular vision. It's Christopher Storr. He's the showrunner. He directed, you know, in season one, he directed five episodes. He directed seven episodes in season two, nearly all of them, right? And you know what you see in most TV shows today that are on streaming, it's a bunch of different writers. The writer on season one, episode one is different from episode two. They have a writer's room. Obviously, Christopher Storr manages the writer's room. But when you have the same guy directing, Lance, all the episodes, what I think happens there is that I think there's a respect level that FX is probably like, this guy knows what he's doing. This guy clearly has a vision. We bought the vision. We are bankrolling this thing. We're going to get out of the way. And when you watch The Bear, you can see it. Like there's no what I would call studio notes. Like there's no there's no committee. There's no executives that are right outside the camera saying do this or do that. You can't put Wilco in there for a third time this season. He's fuck that. He's probably like, I'm going to put Wilco in as much as I want to. I'm going to put as long as we have the budget for it. That work of a singular vision allows. It just allows you to, as the viewer, to sort of trust the process, right? You're going to like, so going back to your question, I don't even care about season three. I'm not even thinking about season three yet. I'm still appreciating what I just watched. But like, I think there's enough in the bank with me by this guy, as long as he's still going to be the visionary, as long as the studio stays out of the way, as long as there's not going to be a writer by committee and that too many people in the kitchen, no pun intended, then I think the show will continue to work. But like, you just don't see this play out very often. The only other show that comes to mind.
Can I guess? Please. Can I guess?
What is it?
what you're going to say.
Sure.
Breaking Bad?
Well, that's not what I was going to say, but that's a great suggestion. No, that's a brilliant one. It's very obviously Vince Gilligan's vision. You know, Breaking Bad was his vision, and you can tell, right? It's just like, even if Vince Gilligan only directed a handful of episodes per season, you could tell that it's his vision. And this is Christopher Storr's vision. The Bear is his vision. It's very obvious. The one I was going to say was True Detective Season 1, the one with Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson. Now, I didn't have the same out-of-body experience watching that show as much as I loved it that I did with The Bear. But Cary Fukunaga, who is the director of True Detective Season 1, directed every episode. He did all of them, and you can tell.
I brought up Breaking Bad because I thought it was another show that as the seasons progressed, it got better because it had a definitive arc to it. To your point, Vince knew how he was going to write the whole thing. I read a story. He knew the ending. He knew the whole thing. He knew it as a 5-year arc. He just knew it. Have you read anything as to whether this already has an arc to it that Storr knows where it's going?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Or is he like, oh shit, I didn't know this was going to go to a second season. I got to write a second season now. Oh shit, I might have to write a third season. Like, cause I would be curious as to whether he has it, because he does have certain things that he is doing consistently though, regardless, right? Like, each episode could at times feel like an ode to Chicago, which it certainly is. Okay.
Yep.
But each episode he shows clips on the L, et cetera. He takes you on the commute every episode. You got to go to work. You got to go home to work from work. You got to go to work. You got to go home from work. And everyone experiences that. And there's this feeling you get when you're going into work, and there's a feeling you get when you're going out of work. And sometimes that feeling is consistent, and sometimes that feeling is not. And he puts that into the episodes to help us get ready for what's going to happen. Gets us ready to work. That's what it feels like. And I think when he treats it that way, I think it at least at minimum frames up the consistency that you are talking about here.
Yep.
When he sets the tone of confidence to make certain calls and patience to make certain calls, I think he sets a bar that's going to be hard for another writer to try and step in and meet for these specific characters in this specific show.
Lance, you see it like play out even in, and this is going to sound silly, but the credits, and I know you enough to know that you noticed shit like this. Okay. Cause I definitely noticed it. There were several episodes this season where the credits just played differently. One of them, they played in reverse. They played it like the Christmas dinner episode. They called it the Brazados, right? That's their last name, I think.
And like, the Brazados, yeah.
And like they renamed it. They played it in reverse. Then there was an episode where they're playing Nine Inch Nails, and they're playing the credits over. What they normally do on the show is they have the credits over black, right? So it's white titles over black screen. This one episode, I think it might have been episode 9, they play Nine Inch Nails over action. Like instead of black screen, they had it over action. And so they're playing that. Credits were in blue, completely different color, completely different style. Then they have episodes where they end it with the Bear. It says the Bear in big giant letters at the end.
The Bear, of course. Yeah.
Fucking arrogant in all the right ways. Like if I were a showrunner like this guy and I know that I'm making this level of excellence for people, I would do that. I would have it see the Bear at the end. So fucking great did they do that. And because, but they only do it in certain episodes. They don't do it in every episode. And then there's other episodes where they named all the actors at the very beginning. That credit usage, just that level of choice, that level of detail. Lance, I know we're starting to geek out here, but like you just don't see that very often in TV shows, those kinds of choices from episode to episode that you are taking the time to change the way you use your credits. Who does that?
Someone who does not feel boxed in by standard approaches to television. I don't think he sees it as television. I think he sees it as an artistic medium. And if
I agree,
and if you are a painter, you're going to care about every brushstroke that you put on that canvas. If you are a sculptor, you're going to care about every chisel that you end up putting into that block. And if you are a TV producer, if you're a showrunner, why would you phone in any of the precious 30 minutes that you get in every episode, or hour that you get in every episode,
right,
or God forbid 22 and a half minutes if you're doing network television? why would you phone in? Every second counts. I mean, that's what every second counts. So you've got 3 minutes of credits. Every second counts. Make them count.
It's magnificent. I've never worked in a restaurant. I've certainly haven't worked in a professional kitchen. I don't know if the Baird gets it right or not, but I've seen enough in the way this show is executed that I'd like to think that they've certainly done their homework. They've certainly done their research. I mean, when you've got little pieces of, like, people are writing notes to each other, right? And they're giving them notes instead of talking in front of the patrons, right? Instead of communicating, they do it via note, right? And in that whole last episode, they're giving each other notes about the bathroom, the toilet, all of it, right? Those little details, it's like these guys, they haven't missed anything. And like that, I mean, in the last episode, Tina, who doesn't get a lot of screen time in this season, you know, she's a tertiary character, right? But, you know,
she's a killer character. She's so good.
She's great. And when Karma's in the walk-in and he's locked in the walk-in and she keeps calling him Jeffrey. And I'm not sure if, you know, everybody necessarily picked up on this, but she calls him Jeffrey. Do you know why she calls him Jeffrey?
Because Jeff sounds like Jeff and she started calling him Jeffrey.
Yeah. Yes. As a sign of respect.
Respect.
Incredible. Yep. Incredible. Like, I mean, that's like something that might just go right past somebody. You might not even like pick up on that or even like take the time to pause and say, hey, why is she calling him that? His name is Carm.
In terms of endearment, yes. to even isolate him further from the other chefs. And the scene that she has at the window. Just the dialogue where, she's even saying it, that some friends just got you. They pick you back up, right? I'm butchering the dialogue, but that's, she gave the motivational speech that was necessary to bring one of their own back into the fray who lost his way a little bit, right? It is impressive how much thought and how much time and consideration. And then, you know, another line that I was with my brother this morning. I actually told him, I said, let it rip, right? Like take the chance, let it rip. And it feels like they are embodying what they're trying to get the characters to embody themselves. But it is amazing how much human complexity they've been able to fit into characters that get sometimes very, very few lines. I mean, even Fak, like that guy I've come to know and appreciate and see his transition and how many possible lines did he have. And then when you see in the episode where they're testing the gas line and you get like two clips or three clips from each person to see what's possibly going through their mind. I felt each of those moments. I felt attached to that character. I felt their pain or then anxiety while they themselves were waiting, because all of them need this restaurant to work. And we're all in situations in life where we need something to work. We do the same flashes through our minds that we saw on the TV show that those folks, so relatable, so relatable.
I want to give a shout out to this actor. I'm not even sure if I'm pronouncing his last name correctly. It's Chris Witowski. He plays Peter, who's Natalie's husband. And he has, you know, what I think is one of the most heartbreaking scenes in the entire season. At the very end, at the very end of episode 10, he goes outside. He meets Jamie Lee Curtis. She doesn't want to go in. The mother, you know, we've already gotten to spend time with her in episode 6, and she can't bring herself to go in and join her kids for their big night. And it's like, and then he finds out that Natalie didn't tell her about their pregnancy, and which was devastating in and of itself. And like that actor, the way he plays that scene out on the sidewalk with Jamie Lee Curtis, and then to go back in and sit back down and play the scene that he does with his wife, and he's crying at the table. Unbelievable.
You know, I saw him in an insurance commercial recently.
Did you?
Right? Like, this is the jump that this show has made and the speed that it has made, right? It was 12 months after the release of season 1, which apparently in the business is unheard of to get that type of quality that quickly, right? It's your point earlier. It has to be coming from the same person in order to be able to pull that off. And the guy's in an insurance company commercials that are still running today. And you have someone make that kind of leap to be in one of the final seasons with Jamie Lee Curtis, who just won an Oscar, right, for a role in Everything, Everywhere.
Yep.
And he delivers on this scene and the emotion and the confusion on what he's feeling. And obviously in a situation where he cannot possibly understand that type of relationship between a mother and a child. He's, that actor is so surrounded by greatness, or is the greatness of the show a magnet for pulling other greatness? Cause the guy was doing an insurance commercial, right? Like, is he just put, is he dropped into the scene, and no matter what brushstroke that ends up on that canvas is going to look great in the overall picture that was going on, or, you know, is he just another, you know, amazing talent that was magnetized and pulled into this obviously wonderful show that we both love.
I mean, look, everybody's throwing threes on that show. And I guess speaking of sports, I got to ask you this before I let you go, but like there is a couple of sports themes in this season, right? There's the Coach K book that Sydney Sydney's reading, and she's watching his videos. All they touch on that a lot throughout the season. And then there's the big speech at the end with Oliver Platt, who I'm a big Oliver Platt guy. And I feel like that guy's been in my whole life of seeing movies and TV shows. I feel like I've watched Oliver Platt age as I've aged. And that guy is like just phenomenal in the show. And he has that big scene where he's giving Carmi the pep talk right before they're about to open. And he does the whole, and you get this because it's the whole Alex Gonzalez, Steve Bartman
Gonzalez
story. How did you feel about that?
I cringed at first when he started to tell the story.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, oh man, like this is the Bartman story, right? Like this is a played Chicago thing. But he took a different angle at it, right? And it's something that a lot of Chicagoans remember dearly, that the Cubs fell apart, right? It was the Cubs fell apart. That Gonzalez could have finished this whole thing. Bartman could have never been known. He could have never been known if the Cubs just did their job. And this was a common conversation in Chicago. And so when at first they started down it, I should have given them the benefit of the doubt, honestly, because they've done everything so Chicago, so right. But as soon as he started telling this, I was like, yes, this is the dialogue that us Chicagoans felt and had following. The folks who didn't understand hung on Bartman.
Yeah, of course.
The folks that understood baseball knew that it was Gonzalez, right? And so the fact that they used that speech was just another indication that the writing is truly in tune with the pulse of the people of the city, seemingly the pulse of the people in the restaurant business, and the pulse of anyone who's feeling the deep-seated, complex feelings that each of the characters are feeling themselves.
There's a gift and a curse that comes from when all the episodes are made available at once. Because, you know, some shows, like I mentioned Hijack earlier, you know, that's one by one. Ted Lasso was one by one. You get one every week, right? And it keeps you going for, you know, 2 months, 2.5 months. But, you know, it was a brilliant thing that I could watch all episodes of The Bear over a 12-hour window at the end of June. And it was phenomenal, right? But when I finished it, like, I have a feeling you said to yourself, I was like, now what? Right. And then my sister said the same thing. My sister finished it a couple of days later. She writes me, she's like, now what am I going to do? And I'm like, and she's like, nothing's going to even remotely compare. So it goes back to that question you asked a few minutes ago about, like, I'm putting it differently, but this whole notion of the success marginalized creativity, right? So season three is going to come eventually, strike, get that out of the way. But like these guys now need to deliver on something. I don't even know if you can, you know, surpass season two, but like as something becomes more and more popular, you see this with bands, right? Bands become more and more popular. They start to change their sound. And I'm not saying that they sell out, and I'm not saying that The Bear is going to sell out. I don't think it will. There's too much excellence. There's too much creative excellence in the show, in the DNA of the show. But you've seen it happen a million times. And you just wonder, like, now what?
Like you, I was not ready for the journey to be over. Right? I did. I felt like I had more to learn. I want to learn more about myself and the show. You know, I'm a lifelong learner, as are you. And the show helped me do that, as I already called out. So yep. I wanted more of that kind of art. But here's what I'm setting myself up for, right? The bear mania seems to be hitting its peak. Season one got a lot of Emmy nods. Season two is going to get insane amount of Emmy nods.
Going to win everything.
Everything. I think season two is going to win everything. They can't give season one all the awards because there are some shows that have finished it. So you're not going to see it win all the awards. But now everyone's going to be like, the bear, the bear, the bear, the bear.
Yep.
And so the people who haven't seen it yet are going to watch it. It's going to hit. It's hitting its mass mania. The issue with that, as you and I both know, and this gets back to the critic element.
Yep.
Is that for season three, it doesn't matter what comes out. Some critics are automatically going to pan it.
You're absolutely right.
Because it will allow them to stand out. It will allow them to look smart because here's this thing that everyone's praising and I get to be one of the first people to take it down. We know that it brings in it's clickbait.
1,000%.
And so what I don't want to see happen is kind of the same thing that happened to my wife in seeing the Barbie commercials. Like now she wants to see it. That all of a sudden there's this deflated natural energy that occurs around this thing because people want to tear it down. They want to tear it down. And so my goal, regardless, coming in, is to give this show the benefit of the doubt because of the joy it's already brought me. And I'm going to treat it more like a friendship than an art.
I love that.
And in what I mean by that is, I don't know how this podcast is going to go. We've had two wonderfully fun times on the podcast together. I don't really care how it came out. I knew I was going to enjoy sharing time with you. And so because of the thoughtfulness, because of the way in which the show approaches itself, I know I'm going to enjoy time with the show. Will it bring about the same moment of clarity that it already brought about? I don't know. Some of the times my friends do and some of the times they don't. But I look forward to each time that I see them.
I was texting you and you're like,
it was your push.
You're like, DC,
that got me to jump in.
You're like, DZ, buzz off. Like, leave me alone. Like, no, you kept saying no spoilers, no spoilers. And I would never have done that to you. So like, I could tell that you needed some time. So I left you alone. But like, I wasn't necessarily intending to talk about this on a pod with you. I just wanted to talk to you about it. Like, I just wanted to talk to my friend and say, Lance, like, because as this episode has proven out, I knew that we were gonna gravitate towards a lot of the same things, the Wilco, all of it, right? And I just couldn't wait to talk to you about it. So I was sitting there just sort of like biting my nails. I'm like, now what, right? I kept saying that to myself. And I wasn't going to do an episode of this. I usually just revisit films. And then I was like walking the dogs one morning. And I think I have such admiration for the show, as you can obviously tell, that I finally said to myself, you absolutely need to get on your podcast and do this. You're an idiot if you don't. Why don't you? Like, I just felt compelled. I was like, I have to get this stuff off my chest. I have to be able to talk about Impossible Germany and Handshake Drugs and Kid Smoke and all this stuff because it's important. It matters to talk about Wilco and the use of music in the show. And if I didn't, I would have been kicking myself for weeks. It's amazing to me the connection that you have with the show is so similar to mine. You pull on certain threads on stuff like this, on shows like this that I obviously do as well. And it's just like it's almost worth rejoicing. It's even if it's poignant and sad and it can be powerful and brought me to tears on Saturday night. But I mean, art doesn't do that very often. So when it does, you sort of need to recognize it. And I knew that you would. It's rare.
It's rare.
I love you as always. Really enjoyed this conversation. I appreciate you opening up as I knew that you would.
You already know the next subject we're going to talk about on this pod together. We just, you know, you get to decide when it's going to happen. But you already mentioned that it was referenced twice inside of the bear. But we're going to talk some baseball, Dennis, at some point. We have to.
Yeah. Well, we were supposed to do Moneyball a couple months ago. and we still can. It's not like the movie's gone. We could do it whenever we want. We could do it during the playoffs or we could do it next spring, which is probably more realistic. Going back to the question I asked you 5 hours ago on this episode is when I said, have you ever seen a movie or a show or a piece of music that moves you in a way that rarely happens? Moneyball is one of those films. It's on all the time, which is good for me because I have that sort of reaction to it. But that's the last major theatrical film that I have seen in the last, I would say, 15 years that I have a very similar bear-esque reaction to. And I think that is why I want to discuss it.
So you asked me a question before. We didn't circle back to it. You called out the circle back. I'll give you one more piece, just to, a quick hit, because your Moneyball was, I think, my Goodwill Hunting.
Really?
Yes.
Did not know that. Interesting.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know Moneyball was that for you either.
Moneyball is, wow, that movie is, geez. I'll give it to you on Goodwill Hunting. That movie is pretty tremendous. So I'm a big fan of that as well. Everybody, thanks for listening. Lance, a pleasure as always. Thanks for being on the show. All the best to you, my friend. It's good to see you.
Love you, DC. Thanks.